This recording is a production of Faith Builders Resource Group. This recording was made at Reach 2019, held on March 22 and 23, 2019, in Lancaster, Pennsylvania.
You know, we think about the poor, and sometimes we ask ourselves the question, how can we really help the poor? Like, we want to, right? Like, we want to do something for the poor. But sometimes we've tried things and we get burned and it doesn't work. And we've seen a lot of programs that are supposed to help the poor that aren't really effective in the long term. It doesn't really work. And so the question is, how can we help the poor? And we've seen things that have been tried and not worked. And sometimes we get exhausted with trying to help the poor when it just seems like there is no tangible result. And it just goes on. And so then sometimes we kind of go to the default position of saying, well, Jesus said the poor will always be with you. So, you know, he didn't know, he couldn't do anything about it, neither can we. So, you know, it's just, that's just the way it is. It's part of the world we live in. But I would suggest to you that there are ways that we can help the poor. And I'd like to talk about a definition of poverty. Bryant Myers, in his book Walking with the Poor, Practices and Principles and Practices of Transformational Development, says, poverty is a result of relationships that do not work, that are not just, that are not for life, that are not harmonious or enjoyable. Poverty is the absence of shalom in all its meanings. And so our premise is that, in Open Hands, where the organization that I work for, is that poverty is not the result of not having things. It's not a result of not having money. It's not a result of not having stuff. Poverty is a result of broken relationships. And when you think about people that you know that are living in poverty, one of the universal characteristics of people living in poverty is they don't have a network of people around them that help each other. So stop and think about it a little bit. If while you're here at Reach, your house burns down, the last thing you're worried about, if you get home and your house is a pile of ashes, the last thing you're worried about is that you're going to be living under a bridge over the weekend. You are not. I don't think there's one person in this room who is going to wind up living under a bridge. The worst thing could happen to you. All your family members could be burned and die, and your house could be gone. Somebody would say, hey, come live with us. We'll help you get, you know, what do you need? And we'll help you get started. People who are wind up in poverty don't have that network of people around them. They're not part of a community that can help them to get back on their feet, take care of issues that come up in their lives. And so then they wind up in abject poverty. They wind up in difficult situations because relationships are not working. And that's the, and so if we're going, if that's the if that's the cause of poverty, if that's why poverty happens, then the solution to poverty is to work on relationships and to work on building community. And that's my premise this afternoon. We work on we respond to poverty with community. And when we create community, poverty just kind of is naturally alleviated because of the community that is around people. Poverty is not simply a lack of material things. The 2017 World Happiness Report, Richard Easterlin reports on growth and happiness in China from 1990 to 2015. And he says, in the past quarter century, China's real income per capita has multiplied over five times, an unprecedented feat. By 2012, virtually every urban household had on average a color TV, air conditioner, washing machine, and refrigerator. Almost 9 in 10 had a personal computer, and 1 in 5 an automobile. Rural households lack somewhat behind urban, but these same symptoms of affluence, which were virtually non-existent in the countryside in 1990, had become quite common by 2012. In the face of such newfound plentitude, one would suppose that the population's feelings of well-being would have enjoyed a similar multiplication. Yet self-reported well-being today is probably less than in 1990. And we know from our own society that wealth doesn't produce happiness. Prosperity doesn't produce happiness. In the U.S., we've experienced sustained economic growth throughout the post-World War II era. Today, most Americans have greater material prosperity than any human beings throughout history. But when Americans are asked to rate their happiness, they don't report being happier. In fact, in the last 10 years, the level of self-reported happiness has actually gone down.
and more objective measures tell an even more sobering story. From the 1930s to the present, a period of unimaginable economic growth in America, levels of mental illness such as anxiety and depression have steadily increased, particularly among young people. That's a quote from Brian Fickard. So material wealth doesn't produce happiness and well-being, and poverty isn't simply a lack of material goods. So poverty, I'm suggesting to you, is an absence of well-being or shalom. It's the absence of relationships that really work for the benefit of everyone. And Brian Fickard from the Chalmers Center for Economic Development says that there are four basic relationships, four primary relationships that result in poverty: the relationship with God, relationship with self, the relationship with others, and the relationship with creation around us. Some people's poverty is caused by their lack of, well, their broken relationship with God. And Peter Greer, who's the CEO of the director of Hope International here in Lancaster, he said that his first experience in microfinance was in Rwanda. And he went into Rwanda and he helped a man to start a small business. And the man he helped to start the small business had kind of a broken down shack. His children weren't going to school. They didn't have enough of food on a daily basis. He helped him to start a business. And in 1 year, his income was triple what it had been before he started the business. So he went back 1 year later and he thought, well, the house is going to be fixed up. The children are going to be going to school and there's going to be enough food. But he said when he went back, everything was the same, except there was three times as much money going through the household. And the extra money, the man now had more money for gambling, more money for alcohol, and more money for prostitutes. So his just increasing his income without a right relationship with God and without a priority on his family, they were worse off with three times as much money than they were before. And so we believe that the relationship with God is primary. And if people are going to make progress out of poverty, having a right relationship with God is foundational to people then having the right priorities in life and so and being able to make progress. And the relationship with self. Many people who are in poverty feel like their life is not under their own control and that they are poor, their situation is hopeless, and they're helpless to do anything about it. And you may see this in your communities here in North America where you have multi-generational welfare communities where people feel like, well, we can't do anything about it, you know, we're just stuck and somebody has to help us and, you know, we need a government program or we need somebody to... So people go from program to program and try to survive that way, but they don't realize that, no, they could take some initiative. There are small things that they could do that would start to turn their life around and things would... But they don't feel like they have that option. They feel like, oh, yeah, you can do that. You have... You know, you have money, you have access to, you have a relationship, you can, you know, somebody will give you a job, you can do things, and but, you know, we can't do that. That's, you know, it's just not possible for me, and so I'm stuck. So I need the government program, or I need somebody to help me. When we first introduced our program in Kenya, we gave our presentation, and one of the men sat with me at, one of the Kenyan men sat with me at lunchtime. And he said, you have to realize when you're making a presentation in our churches that you're not talking to a cross-section of Kenyan society. You are talking to a fair number of people who are here because they're on a support program. And that's why they're part of this church. And they know exactly how much they can earn every month, every year, and stay on the widow's support program. And they're not going to cross that line. Because if they do, they're going to lose the widow support program. So they're not going to do what you're talking about because they are never going to cross that line. But he said when they do that, they're forgetting a couple of things. One of the things they're forgetting is if they cross that line, this year they might be worse off. But 3 years from now, they may be way better off than they would be on the widow support program. He said the second thing they're forgetting is their children are watching them. And their children are saying, they're learning. When you become an adult, you find somebody's support program that you can get on, and then you never get off of it. You just, that's your way of living. And their children are going to follow their pattern. They're going to do the same thing. And I told them, you know what? You're right. That's true. I know that's true. But
There are some people here who are going to look at what we're saying. They're going to say, we can do that. And there are some people who don't know. They're not sure, and they're a little scared to try it. But when they see other people doing it successfully, then they're going to say, hey, I'm going to do that too. And then there are some people here who will never do it, and you know what? They can just stay on the widow support program. And we can't do anything for those people. But there are some who will do it, and there are people who will make progress. But I believe that one of the greatest things that happens, it's not so much giving people more stuff as it is changing their thinking and how they see themselves. And that, you know, there's a thing called the locum of control. Like, who is able to change things in your life? How does change happen? And it's just, you take a young child, and here's a boy who wants a bicycle. How does he get a bicycle? Does he look for the next American that comes and asks for a bicycle? Or does he start working, picking cotton, and then saves money and buys a bicycle? And how that boy answers that question, I want a bicycle, how do I get it, is going to make a difference in how he pursues what he needs throughout his life. And then relationship with others. When you bring a community together, and people, you create a community, and people start caring for each other, and they start helping each other, then you don't need outside resources. And I know that one of the hardest things for me, I will confess, is when I sit in a savings group, and there are women there who are crying and saying, you must give us money. We're trying, and we're saving, and we're doing all that we can do, but it's not enough. And one lady told me, you know, every time I want a loan, there's four other ladies that want a loan, and I know that woman isn't feeding her children every day, and she needs money more than I do, so I let her have the loan. And then I know this woman, she can't send her children to school, and I know she needs a loan more than I do, and so then I never get a loan. But if you would put money into our group, we could all get loans, and then... And it's really hard to sit there and say, no, that's not the answer. The answer to your problem is not for me to give you money so that you can loan to each other. You can do it. Look at what you've done. Look at how much you've saved. You're getting there, and you just keep doing that, and you're going to make it. It's going to work. I was in a savings group in Haiti about 2 years ago, about 30 people in the group. I've known some of those people for 30 years personally, and I know that there are people in that group who their answer to things, their children going to school, fixing up their houses, you name it, their answer was handouts and money from people. I know that's how they have lived their lives. When I was in that group, the treasurer of that group, when they save money, every week they put money into their own savings account, and then they also put money into what they call a help fund. And if somebody has a medical emergency, if somebody has a death in the family, they help them out of that help fund, and they give each other money to do that. And the treasurer of that group told me, Pastor Moreau, nobody in this group asks for charity from anybody outside the group, because we take care of each other. And if anybody in our group has a need, we get the money together and we help them. That's transformational. And the dignity of being able to say, we do that, is amazing. I was in a group one time, and one of the group members, her husband had died the day before. The funeral was going to be the next day. And the president of the group got up and he said, I have an envelope here on the table. You know, one of our group members, her husband died, and we are all going to go to that funeral tomorrow together. And we're going to go, we're going to rent a truck, and we're all going as a group. We're going to sit together at the funeral because we want people in this community to know that we take care of each other. And he said, we're going to give her an envelope with enough of money to pay for the funeral. Because he said, you know where you would be if it was your spouse that had died. So bring money up here. If you don't have it with you today, bring it to the funeral tomorrow. But we are paying for this funeral. That widow lady doesn't have the money, and you know it, and you know where you would be if it was your spouse. So we're paying for that funeral as a group. So people brought money. I looked at how much they were putting in. I was thinking, you know, they're going to do it. And I wanted to put some money in that, but I wasn't sure if I should. After we went out, I talked to our Haitian country director, and I said, man, I kind of wanted to give him some money toward that funeral, but I wasn't sure if I shouldn't. He said, don't you dare do that. You're going to mess up the whole thing. Like he said, there's a huge difference between them going to that funeral tomorrow and giving her an envelope and saying, this is from your fellow savings group members, and we're paying for your husband's funeral, or them giving her an envelope and saying, this is some money from us and some money from that white guy that was at our savings group meeting yesterday, and we're paying for your funeral. He said, they can do it, but don't mess it up. And
So when we have the community in relationship with others, then it can happen. And then some poverty is caused by relationship with creation around us. There are earthquakes and natural disasters that kind of destroy what people have. And those are cases where immediately people need a tent, they need water, they need food, and we just need to give stuff. And there, I'm please don't hear me saying you should never give anything away. I am not against relief. There's a place for that. But when relief becomes a long-term strategy, it becomes debilitating. Most of us would look at multi-generational welfare communities in North America, and we would say the government has destroyed the core of those communities. They undermine fathers in the homes. They've destroyed the initiative to work. They've destroyed those communities. And yet somehow we think we can go overseas as missions and do the same thing and have different results. We can't. We're going to do the same thing, and it just does not work as a long-term strategy. What we think the causes of poverty are lead us to how we try to alleviate poverty. If the cause is a lack of knowledge, then education is the answer. People who live on a dollar a day are not stupid. You try it. And people who live on a dollar a day are very creative, very resourceful, very intelligent, because they don't get $1 every day. They don't start every morning with $1. Their incomes are very irregular, and they may have a long stretch of time where they have no money, and then they get a larger sum of money. And you have to be very resourceful and very creative and very intelligent to live the way half of the world's population lives. I've seen cases where a little bit of knowledge, you give people a little bit of knowledge, they do amazing things with a little bit of knowledge. Just the concept. I was in Uganda in September, and some of the groups there, they told me, we haven't had a culture of saving. Saving has not been part of our culture, but we're going to have a saving culture because we know it's what we need to do. And when we see what we can do with saving, we are going to have a saving culture. And so there was a group of women, they had four or five boys in their group that were 9, 10 years old, and they asked, well, so what are these boys saving for? And their mothers said, well, we want them to learn to save. And we don't have a saving culture, but we want to have a saving culture. So we're bringing our sons here so that they learn to save when they're little. And so they're saving for school books and shoes, and they're going to grow up learning to save. So education is part of oppression. Sometimes oppression is the cause, and then social justice is the answer. Sometimes we have to advocate for social justice and just say it's wrong and it shouldn't be happening. We were in Mexico in one community there, and the drug lords kind of rule the territory. And so the drug lords were coming and planting drugs in the people's cornfields. And somebody had to go talk to the drug lords and say, hey, man, like, leave these people alone. Like, you're extorting money from them. But if you destroy their corn crop, how are you going to get money from them? Like, it's in your own worst interest to destroy their economy. So leave them alone. Like, let them raise corn and then come and extort money from them. But don't mess up their corn crop. Like, don't turn their cornfields into cocaine or drug fields. Like, it's not going to work for them, and it's not going to work for you. So sometimes we just have to talk sense to people who are being oppressive. Then the sins of the poor can be the cause, and evangelism is the answer. And I believe that the relationship with God is primary. And then the lack of resources, where there's a need for relief after natural disasters, that may need to be the cause. The results: if the only response to poverty is to give material aid, then we can do more harm than good. If we give material aid when personal sins are the cause, we just fund more personal sins. If it's oppression, we may channel more resources to the powerful oppressors. When if it's lack of knowledge, they may be used in unhelpful ways. There's a time to give material aid. It should be focused, direct, and brief. Long-term aid programs are unhealthy and undermine the dignity of the poor. So how can creating community help? Creating community restores broken relationships. It allows people to care for each other, allows people to advance together. Part of the problem that happens in communities where there's a lot of poverty is if somebody starts to get something and advances above the rest of the group, everybody steals from them and just kind of pulls them back down. So then nobody advances, and then it takes away the incentive to advance, because if I have 3 goats and my neighbors all have 1, somebody's going to steal one of mine. But if you help people
to advance together so that everybody has three goats, then there's no need to steal because everybody has three. And so common advancement helps people to advance together. It provides dignity of designing solutions and implementing assistance that's community-based and uses resources that are already in the community. So when we go into a community, here's some of the questions we ask, like, what's working? Like, sometimes we go into communities and we say, okay, what's wrong? Like, what are your problems here? And then we have solutions, and we say, okay, like, here's how you can fix your problem. And so we do some teaching, and we tell them, you know, what's wrong with them and how they can fix it. And people in poverty are used to being silenced. They're used to having wealthy people come and kind of tell them what they're doing wrong and how they ought to do it differently. And then you leave, and they're kind of like, well, you know, yeah, that white guy had some interesting ideas, but he doesn't know anything about us. And they could just kind of go merrily on their way and all the bright ideas. I could take you to it right now. I could take you probably to a dozen failed projects around the world where people had fantastic ideas of how the poor could progress, but it was an outside idea. It didn't come from the community. It didn't fit the community. And as long as somebody stayed there and ran it, it worked. And as soon as the person who had the vision for it left, it collapsed. And there are a lot of rusty projects around the world that didn't come from within the community. But when you start with what's working, what works here, and what do you already have, and how can you use what's working and what you already have to help yourself? What can you do? So ABCD is asset-based community development, where you start with what's working, what's right, and you build on that. And you use participatory learning, where when we go into a community and we start teaching, like our business curriculum, for example, and we have our first booklet is on planning a business. The very first question and the very first lesson of the business curriculum is, why would someone want to start a business? And then, what are godly reasons for wanting to start a business? Well, people say it's, well, you provide support for your family, you can give more to the church, people come up with and they know, they have answers. And then when they're done with their answers, if there's one or two things that you have to add to it, you can. But when they look at that, it's like, hey, we knew that. And it wasn't some outsider who came and said, okay, here's three reasons here's three godly reasons to have a business. And they say, okay, all right. And you go on and you go through your material. But when ideas come from within the community, and, you know, I've been to many places where people in savings groups will say, give us ideas. Tell us what business. We want to start businesses, but we don't know what to do. Like, tell us what businesses to start. Give us ideas. And tell them, man, you're asking the wrong person. I don't even live here. Like, think about it. What's needed in your community? What can't you buy here? What do you wish you could buy in your community? What services aren't offered here? What do you have to travel to get? Or what do you wish somebody here was doing? There's your business idea. And think about that. Because what happens in a lot of places is people look at, there's a lady selling soap. And so nine other ladies say, hey, she's selling soap. And that looks like a really good business. I'm going to sell soap too. And then you have 10 women selling soap all beside each other. And then the price, because of supply and demand, the price, they have to be so competitive, nobody makes any money. And maybe being the 11th person selling soap isn't a really great business plan. But what is nobody selling? And that's where just a little bit of information helping people to think through that. And then they think, oh, nobody's selling shoes, so I can sell shoes or whatever. I don't know. But they know. They know what's not in their communities. And they can generate ideas, and then you can say, okay, how much is it going to cost? What do you have to start? And then we help them to develop a business plan. But looking at what they have and letting the ideas come from within the community. Here's some ideas on how community can help. A community that cares for each other. When people trust each other, there can be progress. One of the things that happens in poverty communities is that people don't trust each other, so then you can't form any cooperatives. You can't form a business that takes two or three people as investors, because if you have three people that invest in a business, all three of them are thinking, one of the other two is going to take off with the money, so I better do it before one of them does. And so then nobody trusts each other, and then some things just take larger groups of
of people. One time, a person in an underdeveloped country was telling me, "Well, Pastor Merle, like, white people are so smart, much smarter than us." And I said, "That's not true. Like, why do you think that?" And he said, "Well, just look at what white people do. Like, they build airplanes, they build cars, they all that stuff. You know, they build all that stuff, and we could never do that." And I said, "That's not true." Saying, you will. I challenge you, if you would go to North America, you would not be able to find one person who would know how to build an airplane from start to finish. There's one person who knows how to make tires. And there's one person who maybe understands airplane engines. And there's one person who knows how to build seats. And there's one person who knows how to make windows. But they pool their knowledge and they work together and they form a company and they build airplanes. But one person doesn't know all that stuff. And the problem you guys have is you don't work together. But you have people who know a lot of stuff. And if you could form groups where you'd have enough of people together, you could pool your knowledge, you could build an airplane. But you would all have to have your specialty and have your thing that you do. And then you combine that and put it together. And one of the reasons why there's no progress is because people don't trust each other and they don't work together. And so trust becomes so important. And in a savings group, the key person is, well, there's two key people. One is the president of the group that runs the group, and the other key person is the treasurer, because you have to have somebody that people trust that the money is not going to disappear. And we have groups. We suggest that groups have probably 10 or 12 people to start as a minimum, and we suggest they don't go over about 24. We have groups that have 70 people because there's only one person out of those 70 that they trust to be treasurer. And it takes them forever to save money. Like, people bring newspapers and books along to the meetings because it takes so long for everybody to save money. But they won't divide because they don't see anybody else that they trust as treasurer. So trust is so important. Then the community cares for each other physically, emotionally, and spiritually, just praying for each other and learning to know each other and building trust. You think about if you're in an urban setting here, or even a rural setting, if you're in a setting where you're living among people that are experiencing the effects of poverty, they generally don't have a lot of people around them that care for them. And one of the starting points is just bringing them into community, creating community, and starting to have, because you are willing to give to people that you care about and people that you know personally. And so in the give and take that happens in the community is where community happens and needs are taken care of. You know, the Apostle Paul said, I don't have the verse right in front of me here, but he said something about, you know, the whole, he's talking about the manna and how people who gathered a lot didn't have too much, and people who gathered a little didn't lack, and because people, there was enough for everybody, and it all got shared out. And he was saying, you know, we're not asking you to share out of your abundance so that you are in want, but your abundance right now can help those that are in need, and then later your abundance can help them. And he makes an interesting statement. In English, it says something like, so I forget exactly how it's worded in English, but in some other translations in other languages, in the Haitian Bible, it says, so that everyone will be the same. And I don't think that means so that everyone has the same. It's not so that everyone has an equal amount in their bank account, but it's that sometimes I'm the giver and sometimes I'm the receiver. So we don't have people who are always the giver and people who are always the recipient. And that's what gets devastating. So I think what the Apostle Paul's saying there, I think what Corinthians is saying there, is that we share with each other so that in the end, we're all the same. Because there's dignity in being able to be a giver, and it takes humility to sometimes be the recipient. And so in community, that's what happens. There are sometimes when we're the giver, sometimes where we're the recipient. For us, it probably doesn't happen as much with money as it does with emotional and spiritual support. One time it's your family member that dies and you need people around you that come around you and encourage you and stand by you and grieve with you, and then the next time it's my family member who dies and I need you to come and care for me, and I need to admit my own weakness and say, I just need people right now. I don't know how to wake up tomorrow morning without somebody that I know cares. And so that's what happens in community. And sometimes we don't realize our own poverty because
we think we're rich because of our material wealth. But one of the things that happens to me when I go overseas and I get into places where there's material poverty, I realize my own spiritual and emotional poverty, because I meet people who have a relationship with God that I'm envious of, and a dependence on God that I'm envious of. And I realize I have things that I can learn, and here's some people that have something to teach me, and I can learn about what it really means to be dependent on God. And I just, when I travel overseas, it's a revival for me spiritually, because I realize there are areas of my life where I experience spiritual poverty. So in some ways, we're all beggars, and we're all in poverty in one way or another. We might have the material goods, but we don't have what some communities have emotionally or spiritually. And so we share, and we learn from each other. And in those cases, we can be recipients as well. People who create a community can become islands of shalom in the midst of chaos and crisis. And I just encourage you, if you're in a setting where you're surrounded with people that are experiencing poverty, look for ways to create community. How can you get them together to begin to talk to each other, to care for each other, where you're not coming in as a rescuer, you're not coming in as, okay, we'll fix your problems, we'll take care of you. Where you just start talking to people, how can you help each other? What could you do? What do you have? And do you know other people who are in the same situation you are? What could you guys do to help each other? And how do you think things could start to change here? And what do you think you could do? And for people to take small steps toward restoration of relationships. Now, for Open Hands, we do savings groups in underdeveloped countries. We don't do anything in North America. Keith, does SALT do some things here in North America?
We're starting a program.
You're starting some?
Yes.
So there's
Light.
Yeah, so there's
exactly
a resource.
Training station here in Lancaster County this month.
Yeah, great. So there's a resource for you. We got our model that we use, and the model the SALT program uses as well, comes from the Chalmers Center for Economic Development in Georgia. We use the international track that they have, and the model that we have for how you form a savings group and how it's supposed to work comes from them. They also have a North American track that they're using in communities in North America. And if you're in a North American setting where you're wanting to do something about poverty in your local setting, I really encourage you to get in touch with them. And they have two basic programs. One is called Faith and Finances, and it deals with money management. And as I understand it, what they do is they form groups, but rather than having a treasurer that holds the money for the whole group, everybody has their individual bank account, but then everybody prepares a budget, and then there's accountability in the group for what they're doing with their money, and they're sharing, you know, how much they got, how much money they received, what's in their bank account, what they spent their money for, and there's just some accountability where they help each other to get out of debt or whatever and spend their money wisely. And so that's how it works in the Faith and Finances part. Then they have a second curriculum that's called Going to Work, and it helps people to prepare for the job market and how do you get ready to get a job, because when you're in a community where there's been multi-generational welfare, you may have people that are two or three generations away from anybody that's worked. And so how do you even get a job, and what are some skills that you need to have a job? When we lived in Dryden, I was on the board of the food bank in Dryden, and the province of Ontario initiated a work for welfare program where if you were getting welfare and you weren't disabled or you didn't have preschool children at home, you had to do 20 hours of volunteer work a week in order to get welfare. So the food bank was one of the places where people could come and do their volunteering for their welfare. And so we had people that their families hadn't had jobs for a couple generations. They were 40 years old. They had never had a job. And they would come to the food bank and volunteer 20 hours a week. And the food bank manager we had was really great at just helping them to, okay, like we open at 9 o'clock, So, like, if you want to drink coffee before you start, like, maybe you should come at 8:45 and drink coffee. So when 9 o'clock comes, we're ready to go. And secondly, you're serving the public. Like, people are coming in here, so it's really nice if you brush your teeth and comb your hair and shower before you come to work. Like, that would be really great. And you know, we had people that they could be there for 6 months. And we had people that after 3 or 4 months, they said, hey, I could work anywhere. Yeah, you could. Because they developed skills. But they started to realize, hey, this is how it works. But think about it. If you never had a job and your dad never had a job, your mom never had a job, how would you know what you're supposed to do? It's great to get a paycheck, right? But how do you get a paycheck? And how does this work? And so just some coaching. And the Chalmers Going to Work program just helps people with some of those things. And so I just encourage you, if your church is interested in doing something locally with people in poverty, they have some great resources. I think you have to go to one of their trainings. It takes a little bit of time and effort to actually get it. Maybe Keith can come and do it for free for you. I don't know, but
there's a fee for ours too.
Okay, so
we don't give anything away.
Yeah, all right. Good for you. And then here's a book, When Helping Hurts, which probably many of you have read. Here's another book, From Dependence to Dignity. Again, this probably deals more with underdeveloped countries than with the North American setting. Here's a new book that just came out 2 weeks ago called Becoming Whole. And this is, actually, these books are kind of backwards in the way they should have been published, because this one lays the theological background, the theological basis for why just material wealth isn't the answer to poverty. This is I just finished reading this, and this really lays the theological foundation. It doesn't give. They're coming out with a field guide to this book in September, which will give 19 practical steps of how you do this. But it really deals with the theology of why work is good and just the whole underlying thinking of helping people in poverty and creating that shalom that helps people to have spiritual wellness and being able to then reach out. And so I just encourage you to any of these books, but this one is really good in laying the foundation. You know, a number of years ago, Edith and I were at a conference, and Obi Mekredi was there. He was the Grand Chief of the Assembly of First Nations in Canada. There's like 600 First Nations in Canada, and they each have a chief, and then they have regional chiefs, and then they have the National Grand Chief. And Ovid Mekredi was the National Grand Chief, and he was talking in his talk about how the First Nations communities in Canada went from being prosperous communities where the men were building log houses and they were taking care of their families and they were trapping and fishing and they were providing for their families, to where they got moved into communities and started going on government support programs, and the men became kind of irrelevant because the check was coming from the government, and so the men started drinking and everything went into chaos, and you have broken families and all the social and spiritual disorientation that happened in the First Nations communities. And then he was talking about how we need to rebuild a strong nation, we need to get back to the basics, and we need to get our act together, and we need to put the pieces back together, and we need to build a strong nation, get our families back together, get men working, we just have to rebuild the structure of our nation. And Edith and I were sitting across the table from him at lunchtime, and so I told him, Obi, you know, you've been talking about a lot of things that went wrong, and there's the spiritual piece, there's the economic piece, there's the social piece, there's family, there's all these things that are broken in many places in the First Nations community. So now you're going to build a strong nation, and you want to restore all of those things. What sequence do they have to be put back together? What's the first piece that you have to put back in place? And he said, well, you are in the right business, because the first piece is spiritual. And he said, first of all, people have to know that they are a creation of God, and they have to know that they can have a relationship with their creator. And when they get that straightened out, then the other pieces can be put in. So if that piece isn't in place, you can help people economically, you can help them socially, but in just a matter of time, they're going to degenerate back to where they were. And so this book does a good job of laying the theological. And so you guys are in the right business, because the spiritual piece is the big one. And you get that in place, then you can start putting the other pieces in place. And so I just encourage you to get involved. Any questions? Yeah, we have a few minutes here.
How do you create buy-in for the people that want to, maybe, or for a program that you would like to start?
The big, the reason why people want to get involved is because they see an opportunity for improvement, and they want things to change, and so they're looking at the desperation they live with and the chaos they live with and just the hope that things will get better, and it seems to them like an avenue of things are going to improve. Other questions?
I'm speaking from a context of like urban American,
okay, yeah,
attitude, and I'm totally agreed about the community, you know, building this community,
right,
first. I'm noting, or we're noticing, that people are resisting community because they're resisting accountability. They don't want each other in their business.
Right.
And it seems like it's an American dilemma. Do you have any answers to that? When we're in an urban setting, we can't realistically think that they're all going to become converted,
right,
and then start a savings group,
right,
and all that.
Yeah.
But we want to help them build community,
right,
and yet they're very mistrustful and shy of accountability.
Right.
Can you speak into that at all?
What we do is lay the groundwork of what makes it work. The spiritual piece is the foundation, and then trust is right on that. Having leadership and policies, discipline, rules, that, you know, the way things function is important. And you may have to start with a very, very small group of people that are willing to trust each other, and then you model. That becomes a model where other people look at that and say, hey, that something's happening there, that I'm willing to give up some privacy or individualism in order to gain the benefits. But you may start out with a very small group of people. It may only be two or three, but you look for those. And then as other people watch, they see what happens. But you don't have to have 10. You can start with two or three. And I think you have to have enough where you don't have, or if you're facilitating the group, that they're not just looking to you, where you're going to give us everything. Like, you have to have enough where they can actually help each other, and where, so, yeah. But even if you have three or four, they can probably start doing some things in a very small way. That would be my suggestion. But yeah, some people will walk away and I'm not interested in that. I don't want to give up my privacy. I'll just do it myself.
Do you see this among the men as well as the women? Or in a Native community, it seems like so many of the men are just kind of floating.
Yeah. I started a savings group in one First Nations community in Ontario, and that one was primarily women. And I would say, out of all our programs, probably we're at 90% women overall. The only exception is Ethiopia. In Ethiopia, it's almost all men. And the reason is, in Ethiopia, it's a shame for a man to not provide the food and the tuition money. Where in most countries, that it's the other way around. It's the mother who's providing the money for food and tuition, and the men just have their thing they do, and they just walk away from it, and they're not responsible for it. So
often it's the women that are desperate. They want help for their children, and so they participate. However, we had one slum community in India where people are working in the stone quarries, and they're like basically bond servants in the quarries, and they're pooling their money and getting each other out of the quarry. But they started a savings group, and the men didn't want the women to do it because they wanted them to work in the quarry. So the women started having a savings group meeting at 6 o'clock in the morning, which in India is absolutely counterculture. Like, things do not start in the morning. I promise you, nobody's doing anything at 6 o'clock in the morning. But they wanted to do it. So they started having their meetings at 6 o'clock in the morning. When the men saw what they were doing, they said, well, they can stay home from the quarry for a bit and do their meeting. And so they were able to have it later in the morning. After a couple of years, the men said, well, we want to be in these savings groups too. And so then now they have men in the savings group, and some of the men got saved. And now when the men's money isn't going to gambling and alcohol, and both the husband and wife are in the savings group, it's revolutionized that slum community. And they had one guy in the community that his job was to set the dynamite in the quarry. And they didn't have any detonator, so he put like 20 sticks of dynamite in and then run along and light all the fuses and then run for his life. And one time when he was running for his life, he fell and hurt himself, and then he couldn't work in the quarry anymore, so his wife was supposed to work in the quarry because he has this debt to repay. So his savings group pooled their money, and they gave him money to make a down payment on a taxi, so now he drives taxi. And then after they did that, then they pooled their money again, and they helped one of the ladies start a little store, and she sells food. So now she's not working in the quarry. Then they helped another lady get some goats. And now she has this, like 2 years ago she started, now she has like 20 goats. So she doesn't have to work in the quarry. So one by one, they're getting each other out of the quarry. The quarry owner told us, man, you guys got to quit this. Like, you're ruining my people. We said, go find more poor people. There's lots of poor people in India, but we're taking these. So
anyway, that's...
Thank you very much for being here.
This recording and many others are available from Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. For more information, call 1-814-789-4769 or visit us online at www.christianlearning.org.